Welcome to Foreman and Wolf on Food and Wine. I'm Tony Foreman.
And Chef Cindy Wolf.
And Cindy, this is a topic that that everyone has feelings about.
Yeah, because they love champagne.
We were joking before beginning the program about you know,
what is champagne?
About people's feelings and various therapies. And I was just thinking, the fantastic therapy is drink good champagne.
Exactly, that'll solve at least one problem.
Matches many meals and many moods, right?
Mm-hmm. That's the great thing about champagne.
So
it's not just for celebrating.
Now, you have a whole agenda of champagne that you want to chase, do you not?
I do.
Okay.
There's so many that
so
I love.
So you not the champagnes you want to drink. But,
oh, that's not what you meant.
No, I mean something more of an academic and historic agenda.
It
right?
is, because I think it's such an amazing region. It has such a tremendous history, and I think you probably know a lot more about it than I do.
I know for certain that it is something driven by a number of historical factors, and I know for certain that it is driven by like any wine growing region in the world, or any agricultural region in the world, is driven by the weather. And the weather, a lot of people say, "Oh, I want to go to Champagne. It's going to be amazing. We're going to be there in April or March."
Ooh.
Or
and it's going to rain
October,
on you
November
the whole
or something.
Time you're
it's
there.
Just like, ugh. You've got, if you're lucky, you've got 60 nice days in the summertime where you might catch sun and it may be warm enough to not wear a sweater. But, I mean, the defining factor is the weather is cool and cloudy and cold a lot of the year.
Mm-hmm. And they have pretty good snowfall there, too, don't they?
They do. And all of these things lead to great vine vigor, which they need because they plant every, you know, square meter incredibly densely. That's one of the things that strikes you when you visit the region compared to almost anywhere else is the way that the property is used. It has to be used at this point in the trajectory of the wine business in Champagne. The property is worth an awful lot of money. It
mm-hmm.
has to produce.
Okay.
The quantity of wine that the region produces per hectare under vine is enormous, you know, compared to almost anywhere
else.
They're good at it. I mean, they're good at it, and the history of the region, I think, has driven it to be competitive in all things, not just in farming and in quality, but in quantity and in promotion and marketing. I think that Champagne, that's something coming out of the 1870s that was worried about its marketing and its brands and its imagery and who their final clients are going to be and how do we get this stuff to market and how do we get this stuff to the right buyer. And there are champagne houses that, you know, that were purely chasing the English market or purely chasing the Russian market or purely chasing, you know, Louis Roederer is famous for chasing the Russian market, and Cristal is the bottling made for, you know, for the czars. There are many, many, many different, I mean, that's without getting into everyone's specifics, that's something to kind of realize. And you're in an area where from the Franco-Prussian War on, from 1870 on, And the big growth of the German Empire between that and the First World War and its economic influence and Bismarck's economic influence and the flow of money around Europe, Champagne flowed with a lot of that. And even though it's in France, Champagne is right where the wars have marched through for how many centuries, and it's right on the edge of where Reformation broke.
Mm-hmm.
And it's important to realize the competitiveness of the Catholics and the Protestants and the Germans and the French and all the different chauvinisms back and forth that kind of pit neighbor against neighbor in a kind of civilized way, but in a very business competitive way. And that had to do with relationships with farmers or buying vineyard sites and digging caves. There's so many details of it. It's crazy, but each house's history. If someone wants to look up a house with an interesting history, say Tattinger,
mm-hmm.
they have Roman caves, the Cryer, the chalk sort of inverted pyramids.
Which are amazing to see.
That they still use as their cellars.
And it literally does look like white chalk. You can't imagine
that
they dug through that and made these cellars.
But it is spaced like a pyramid inside of mm-hmm. the ground that begins at the spire at the surface. and comes down, and these are all connected with tunnels, and there are so many tunnels that were connected or filled or covered or mm-hmm. walled up during the course of various centuries. But the methods, the method, and the place is the place, the soil is the soil. It's a unique situation, but not just because of weather and because of the particulars of the terroir, but because of the people and the arc of history and the relative wealth and competitiveness of the people in that region.
Well, and to have 8 centuries of kings crowned in Rheims means, you know, there has to be a certain prestige to that as right. well, that, you know.
I think it's less, I'm a little bit like, well, you know, who gets paid?
Mm-hmm.
The question is not the prestige. The question is, why was that being done? It's because the cardinal in Reims was the most senior of the French church, okay. typically.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that since that's the seat for the French church, you know, the political influence of the church running through France was driven through Reims, which means also that the vineyards that they held for most of the time that Champagne has been made, you know, they've either sold to make the church more wealthy or they've held and sold the wine. I mean, the vineyards, most of the vineyards in Champagne were owned by the church, and most of them were cultivated by monks and then by the various peasants over the years. And then over time, you know, farming families and so on. But that's, history in Europe and history in a wine growing region like Champagne is very different from, say, in Napa 50 years ago, some guy named Joe bought a ranch and his grandfather used to make wine.
Sure. In, very different.
You know,
mm-hmm. tremendous
along
history.
The Danube. And he decided, well, I like this grape. Everyone seems to like this grape. I'm going to grow this,
mm-hmm.
you know, and Joe Heitz's family winery.
Right.
It's a little different from these guys that have been chasing each other, beating each other up, competing with each other for, you know, 10 generations
mm-hmm.
in the same little town next to each other. I think that's kind of a different story. That the question I have for you is, what do you think, how do you think that's impacted the food of the region? How do you think that that kind of lousy climate, you know, climate, lousy soil, but a wealthy populace, relatively wealthy populace. How has that affected what the cooking is like?
Not a lot of vegetables being grown there. Beets.
Well, it's impossible.
Right. So, you know, it's mostly grapes. So you have very little fresh vegetables, you know, based in the cooking. And you have, andouillette are two sausages that are made there that are very famous and very particular to that region. The butchers and the shops there kept their recipes pretty secret, as they did with Boudin Blanc, which is also traditional to that region. And Boudin Blanc is a white sausage, so it would be made from the lighter portion cuts from pork and also chicken, and even maybe later on from veal. And it would always be sort of finished with egg whites whipped and folded in, I read a recipe for, and egg yolks folded in and a little bit of spices. But it's a very, one of the things about Boudin Blanc is the texture of the sausage is very fine because they really grind the forcemeat to its finest point. So it's a very sort of almost fine sausage with the Boudin Blanc. The andouillette is really tripe sausage. So it is, when they make the andouille.
So that's not refined. That's big flavor.
Far from refined. And it's very sort of guttural, very base in flavor.
A lot of affection for that.
Yeah, I know you love that. And I think, especially Americans traveling to that region need to realize that andouille is not like what we make in the southern part of the United States, which is a spicy, cold smoked pork sausage.
It is made from ground pork, not from the
intestines, which is what andouillette is.
It is a mean-spirited piece of humor that I will admit I engage in when I see someone ordering andouillette.
In France. And you don't tell them.
Who's American. Well, yeah. I'm like,
yeah.
Do I tell them? Do I not tell them?
Well,
As the years have gone by, I've gotten nice and I tell them more often.
The two sausages differ in that one has part of the pork belly and the tripe or the intestine, and one has less. And so that's really the difference between andouille and andouillette. But, you know, they're very particular to that area. And that region is also famous for several different cheeses. Sambre, which is a cheese that has ash on the outside of it, is very particular to that region. Lancret is made in Champagne, and that's one of my, well, and actually in reading about that as well, realizing that part of the process of making Lancret, of course, it has a sort of a beautiful gold or orange exterior because the annatto seed is mixed with the salt because it's a washed rind cheese. So as they rub that into the outside of the cheese, it affects the color. And of course, aging brings on more color and depth to the color of the cheese, Lancret. But they never turn the cheese in the process of aging. It's a relatively fresh cheese. It's not aged more than probably 4, 5, 6 months. But it actually creates a natural sort of dip in the top of the cheese. And traditionally, they would either pour Marc de Bourgogne into the cheese or champagne. And I think that's pretty amazing to think that that's what they used to do.
That's the point you're making is it's funny. I mean, that's you're talking about stuff driven by animal husbandry, which is what's available, but it's available because people can actually afford the animals. Like I said, a relatively wealthy culture in Europe for a long time, driven by dairy.
Mm-hmm.
And even the cheese is there to sell the wine.
Well, apparently, yeah, they make
their living selling the wine. I mean, that's
sure. Well, and the land is obviously good for grazing because they do have cattle and milk cows. So, you know, it may not be the best for growing vegetables, but it is certainly good for grapes. And talking about the grapes, I think, I recently had dinner with a winemaker from Veuve Clicquot, and that was quite a treat. And just hearing him talk about, you know, who they buy from, I think it's interesting in Champagne. Tell me if I'm right or not. It seems like there's an awful lot of people growing grapes, but not so many people producing it. In other words, a lot of grapes are sold to the big houses.
Well, yeah, you're in the midst of a pretty good sized change after Champagne. Champagne was overwhelmed. The last 30, 40 years has become, on a percentage basis, incredibly high as far as the percentage of the handful of biggest growers, let's say the 10 biggest growers, who buy grapes.
Producers.
And producers and produce the wine.
Mm-hmm.
And that you're watching now, it's probably the single biggest trend in Champagne, are smaller growers that want to do high-quality work, that do something, you know, like Jean-Marc Selec or... Or Geoffroy, or yeah, I mean, there's, and for me, that's a big passion is finding those little individual growers that do very particular work and don't make everything to something. You know, I'm going to be a little negative and say something of a middling standard, because they have so many millions of bottles to sell. We come back on Foreman & Wolff on Food and Wine a little more on Champagne's history. We'll get into a few recipes and more specifics about Champagne houses and what is and what is not Champagne. On WYPR.